Tonight, we will give you a brief peek at scenes from those films nominated for Best Picture of 1962. They are Lawrence of Arabia, a Horizon Pictures Limited Sam Spiegel David Lean production, Columbia, produced by Sam Spiegel.
The whole film glows, even the very first shot, which is a very, very boring shot, the overhead picture of a middle-aged man in tweeds mucking around with his motorbike. I mean, you know, what could be more boring than that? And yet there's something almost golden and sumptuous and inviting about that image that tells you that this film is going to be one hell of a ride.
Somehow one had a gut feeling that it was a fantastic film. The material was just amazing. The desert stuff and the mirage stuff. I mean, the locations they chose were so fantastic.
I had the hardest master of them all, David Lean, for 2 years. Who is a hard bastard. By God, he is. But what he doesn't know about cinema is not worth knowing.
I love getting near a camera and a camera crew. And I like doing films in rather wild places. I find wild places exciting.
Oh, it's a knockout. And, you know, when people see this film, they're still blown away.
The star opens the envelope as fast as possible without risking a paper cut, takes out the card and reads, and the winner is, in this case, Lawrence of Arabia, Best Picture for 1962. These days, more sensitive language is used. The Oscar goes to Crash or The Departed, or whatever has won the gold statuette bestowed by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Rare is the workplace that does not have an office pool on who will win that year's Oscars. Yet even the film world's greatest experts can't define what qualifies a movie or a performance for the superlative best.
The type that usually wins Oscars is something that you know is going to have a shelf life, something that is really well made, and they love big, imposing themes. But other than that, you can't really say there is a definite type of film to win an Oscar.
It rewards the film that coincides most directly with what the establishment in the American film business wants to think about itself. We're doing good work, we're making a profit, but we're treating serious things seriously.
I mean, I once interviewed Billy Crystal about the Oscars, and he said when he was a kid, you know, growing up on Long Island, and the show would start and would say the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, he said he had this vision of this, like, temple up on a hill in Los Angeles and people in robes, you know, walking around discussing film. It's nothing so grand. It's just people, they're prey to the whims of the moment, they're prey to likes and dislikes, and that comes out in the voting. And sometimes decades later, you look and you say, you know, what were they thinking?
Kenneth Turan, Bob Osborne, and David Thompson are noted Hollywood historians who have spent measurable parts of their lives studying movies awarded by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Today, the glamorous televised ceremony lasts over 3 hours, but the entire Oscar industry started off with a 5-minute ceremony in an upstairs room of the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel 80 years ago. The hotel still stands. I could not resist a pilgrimage.
I'm standing on Hollywood Boulevard outside the Roosevelt Hotel. As a matter of fact, I'm standing on the star of Vanessa Williams. I'll just move over now. This is the Walk of Fame. Randy Quaid is there. Nancy Sinatra. Irving Thalberg. There's a great old movie name. And indeed, I'm here to salute the great old movie event because had I been here May 16th, 1929, I could have been walking in this very foyer. I'm now passing the star of Mayor Tom Bradley to the very first Academy Awards. We walk into the lobby, and it was here that I could have bought a copy of the Los Angeles Times first edition and read who was getting the awards, because there were no envelopes that first year. But I'm going to now turn to Laura. You work here for the hotel.
What's interesting is the awards themselves were held upstairs in a room that at the time was called the library, where the Motion Picture Association held all of its meetings. There was only 250 attendees, and they only gave out 3 awards. They then came down to the Blossom Room, which is most commonly thought of to be where the actual awards were held, and that is where they had the reception.
And I'm wondering then if we are allowed to go to the library.
Okay.
It's very interesting because the Academy Awards are so famous now and have made the Academy famous, but it was not originally set up for awards.
Bob Osborne of the Los Angeles Times is the Academy's official historian and is well aware of the irony in this year's speculation as to how the writers' strike will affect the Oscar ceremonies.
The Academy was actually organized way back to kind of handle labor disputes, because the major studios that ran Hollywood, they didn't want unions in telling them what they had to do. So they thought, if we have an organization here in Hollywood that can settle these disputes, maybe the unions won't come in. Well, the unions did come in almost as soon as the Academy was organized. So that main aim of the Academy was no longer necessary. That wasn't the main thrust. But they had other things. They wanted to have an extensive library where people could come and study about film. And way down the list, they were going to give awards of merit. They didn't know if it was going to be a scroll, a piece of paper, a plaque, a statue, whatever. And covering the years 1927-28, a seasonal year, instead of a calendar year as it is now, they started giving those awards in 1929. And that caught on like wildfire.
We're now going to climb the stairs. It's a beautiful staircase.
This staircase was actually where Shirley Temple practiced her famous stair dance. And then the Academy Room's back here where we're heading now.
In those days, everybody went to the movies. It cost about 25 cents for people to pay to go to see a movie, and everybody went. There was nothing else to do in the evenings. It wasn't really, though, until later that television came along, really, that the Academy Awards started becoming so terribly commercially important to Hollywood, because people were not going out to the movies very much then. They were staying home and watching television for free. So the best promotion you could possibly get was to win an Academy Award.
And then, as you can see, it still has its original ceiling.
You can see why this would have been an attractive room at its time.
Yeah, imagine it with wood-paneled walls and a fireplace, and then, of course, overlooking Hollywood Boulevard.
And it was in this room that three Academy Awards were given out. Janet Gaynor was Best Actress for a multiplicity of films. Of course, that doesn't happen anymore. Only one film can be nominated. Emil Jennings won for The Way of All Flesh, which no longer exists. You cannot see the Best Actor performance from the first Academy Awards. And Wings was named the Best Picture.
I think it was, without doubt, the first proper aviation picture. What is so extraordinary about it is that it is shot in a style which people would recognize at once as being modern. In other words, the camera is constantly on the move.
Film historian Kevin Brownlow talking about Wings, the first and last silent movie to win the Best Picture Oscar. Brownlow has in his possession the Oscar the cameraman won.
This is the Academy Award presented to Charles Rocha, the very first Oscar for cinematography. But oddly enough, they put the man's name underneath the Oscar. So you have to pick it up to look at it.
Oh, indeed you do.
Mrs. Rocha had polished off all the brass over the years.
It weighs proverbially a ton, and it is actually credited to George Stanley.
Yes, so I've never seen that on an Academy Award.
Yes, before. So he's the sculptor, one would imagine.
Yes.
Quite a beautiful piece. I mean, they got it right, because many awards have had to be redesigned through the years.
It is so imitated, isn't it? There's so many other awards that look so like it.
Yes, well, since his name is not on the front, I can, for a moment, imagine that this is mine.
The winner is Lawrence of Arabia, Sam Stevens.
Lawrence of Arabia is an interesting example because I think it perfectly fits the criteria for a best picture.
New York University Film Studies professor Dana Pollan believes David Lean's classic ticked all the Academy boxes.
Hollywood likes the historical film, films that seem to be suggesting that this industry, normally thought of as an entertainment industry, can reach into the past and give us historical reflection. It has that sense of high class, high culture through the use of British actors. If it's on the one hand based on a literary work, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, so literary adaptation matters, historical reflection matters, Britishness matters.
And of course it has the intermission.
Yes, length itself suggests seriousness.
an accomplishment. And I think, you know, Lawrence clocking in at close to 4 hours has that.
But cinema history is full of long films that floundered. Lawrence was much more than a lengthy biopic with a Shakespearean actor in the lead role. It is a masterpiece that presents in a form palatable to the mass audience box office no-nos, such as a morally ambiguous hero, that hero's death, racism, and male rape. Lawrence boasts memorable music, stunning cinematography, Omar Sharif appearing like a mirage on the desert horizon, and Peter O'Toole appearing impossibly beautiful. As Noel Coward said, if he had been any prettier, it would have been Florence of Arabia. The unforgettable shots of sand and sky were the result of 2 years filming on location, a luxury that would be inconceivable today, but were a necessity for director David Lean.
I went to the deserts of Jordan and Morocco. Some of the most stupendous days I've ever had in my life. And I've got this bug of making movies outside, mostly because traveling excites me.
David Lean had already experienced Oscar success with Bridge on the River Kwai, Best Picture of 1957. I asked Kevin Jackson, author of The Making of Lawrence of Arabia, if the earlier epic had influenced Lean's choice of subject.
There was definitely a sense for Lean that he needed to sustain the extraordinary international reputation that he'd achieved with Bridge Over the River Kwai. It's curious that some 10 years, actually, before the Spiegel production got underway, Lean had already had discussions about the possibility of doing a Lawrence of Arabia project. And I think when it did come along, he realized that it was exactly the kind of subject at which he could excel.
Whenever the American Film Institute draws up its list of the greatest 100 American films, Lawrence is in the top 10. Does this make you bristle?
It's a tricky one, that, because in some ways it is culturally such an English film. I suppose one has to follow the money, and one has to say that without Spiegel, who's sort of an American, I suppose one could say, it really wouldn't have been possible. So it needed Spiegel's particular energy and entrepreneurial skills.
I think David Lean, for good and ill, was always a director who got at the English personality.
Film critic David Thompson.
And I think it's a very English film, and I think that his conception of Lawrence as a largely repressed homosexual who does what he does because of that, I think it's a very English point of view, certainly from the early 60s, you know, when I think that homosexual behavior was still against the law.
I recall the New York Times on the front page around that year had CIA vice purge. You wouldn't even have known unless you knew what the vice actually was.
What the code was.
Yes.
You could argue that the film doesn't address it very much either. It's quite indirect.
Good morning, sir. Salute! If you're insubordinate of me, Lawrence, I shall put you under arrest.
It's my manner, sir.
What?
My manner, sir. It looks insubordinate, but it isn't really.
Well, I can't make out whether you're bloody bad-mannered or just half-witted.
I have the same problem, sir.
Shut up!
Yes, sir.
The list of people who have been cast over, shall we say, about 4 decades for the role of Lawrence is extraordinary. It includes, of course, Alec Guinness was at one time considered for the part. Robert Donat had been considered. Leslie Howard had been considered for a long time. Though, curiously enough, it was Marlon Brando who was originally cast for the role of Lawrence, which led, of course, to a witticism at the press conference where somebody said, is this a non-speaking role? Because, of course, Brando was already famous for being a great mumbler. But I don't think that anyone now could seriously conceive any other actor bringing to it that intense combination of charisma and intelligence that O'Toole brings to the part.
I'm sorry, sir, but you're wrong. Fall back on Yanbo, sir, and the Arab rising becomes one poor unit in the British army.
What is this to you?
Lawrence, do you know you're a traitor?
No, no, Colonel. He is a young man, and young men are passionate. They must say their say.
I remember sitting in a black tent in a place called El Jaffa.
Peter O'Toole was interviewed in the middle of filming Lawrence and discussed researching his role on location.
And someone said, oh, Abdi would know better. And they shouted for this man. And in clanked a huge Sudanese gentleman of about 80. And he was a slave, a now freed slave, whom Awud Abu Tai, who was one of Lawrence's chief warriors, gave to Lawrence to look after him. And someone said, what did Lawrence look like? He pointed at me and said, him.
I mean, it was very interesting watching Peter O'Toole, because he hadn't done anything comparable with this before, and watching his performance come together. Omar Sharif also got the part because the original actor had blue eyes and wouldn't have brown contacts put in. So it was very interesting watching these actors and, you know, watching their performance evolve.
Anne V. Coates, the film editor of Lawrence of Arabia, received her first Academy Award nomination for that movie. Film editing was a category introduced in 1935 at the 8th Oscars. The categories gradually expanded, with Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role first awarded in 36. Walter Brennan won 3 of the first 5. In 1962, the Egyptian Omar Sharif was nominated for his supporting role in Lawrence. He was the only non-white actor in the cast. Sharif remembers receiving a phone call in Cairo, summoning him to audition with David Lean.
I came to the desert on this little plane, and the film unit was in the middle of nowhere, really, in the middle of the Jordanian desert, and this plane landed right in the middle of the desert. And in the desert where the plane landed, there was one man standing, nobody else. And I came off this plane, and this man took 2 steps towards me and shook my hand and looked really through me. I mean, he looked into my eyes and looked to my profile and looked everywhere with these very piercing eyes that he's got, and said, Omar, I'm very pleased that you're here.
I think you have to work on hunches. I like meeting people, talking to them. I have an idea of the character, a very strong idea of the character I want them to play, and I think, I wonder if you could do this, and I ask them a few questions, and if they seem, as it were, simpatico with the type of character I have in mind, I generally take a plunge and go for them.
Now, a gathering of international stars unfolds the story. Alec Guinness as Prince Faisal.
The English have a great hunger for desolate places. I fear they hunger for Arabia.
Anthony Quinn as Auda Abu Taihi.
I carry 23 great wounds, all got in battle. 75 men have I killed with my own hands in battle.
I'm not in the camp of steadfast David Lean admirers, and I think that when you look back and see Alec Guinness and Anthony Quinn playing notable Arab parts, you're touching on a kind of blind failure to understand Arab culture, the fruits of which are coming home to us day by day, year by year. There was a long, long period in which Arabs in the movies could be played by actors of any race, nationality, so long as they were villainous or devious. That's really all an Arab had to be. And I suspect at the time that Sam Spiegel, the producer, and Lean thought that they were doing a big, big service to, in quotes, Arabia, by casting an Egyptian actor, Omar Sharif, in the film.
Lieutenant Lawrence, sir, is not your military advisor.
But I would like to hear his opinion.
Damn it, Lawrence, who do you take your orders from?
From Lord Faisal, in Faisal's tent.
Old fool! Why turn from him to him, their master and man?
I can perfectly understand how people would find it offensive, but I think that Lean was utterly free in his personal life of racism, and in fact he regarded racism as extraordinarily stupid as well as evil. And I think in the casting of someone like Omar Sharif, you see that he actually wasn't at all averse to using a Middle Eastern actor if it seemed appropriate. I fear that it's the old thing, isn't it, that the colour that Hollywood most worries about is not black or white but green, and that had he cast a number of unknown actors in the Middle Eastern parts, he simply wouldn't have found it so easy to finance the film.
Author Kevin Jackson, and before him, David Thompson. One of the main presences in Lawrence of Arabia does not speak. It's certainly the best performance by a desert in a film, although The Dunes and The English Patient are very nice.
But there is, of course, the natural phenomena observed in the arrival of Omar Sharif in Western cinema. That's one of the most famous shots ever.
It's famous, of course, for its extreme duration. In fact, I think for younger viewers who are used to a much more accelerated pace of editing, it might be agonizingly slow. But certainly, I think everyone who sees the film for the first time is entranced by this. Again, it's almost a mystical moment, isn't it? It's almost as though the character appears out of the void. It's as though the desert air is solidified into this strange character who in some ways represents the desert. Really, a tremendous and poetic moment, I think.
It took us a long time to cut that scene, actually, and we cut it a lot of ways because it was tricky. Tricky just exactly which piece of the mirage. I had thousands of feet of mirage shot with three cameras. It took a long time. The time that David had to shoot it was fairly a luxury, but we had one of the shortest times in history to cut the film and dub it in. It was a 3-hour, 40-minute film, and we had to do it in 16 weeks.
So for a time, you had the director of the film over your shoulder, as it were.
David, once he wasn't shooting, was always over my shoulder.
Now, the nominees for film editing are Ann Coates for Lawrence of Arabia, Samuel E. Beakley.
Ann V. Coates was just one of Lawrence of Arabia's Kraft nominees on Oscar night. The film also won Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, Freddie Young, Best Sound, and Best Score, Maurice Jarre. But Ann's category of film editing came first.
Ann Coates for Lawrence of Arabia.
Accepting on behalf of Ann Coates, Mr. Robert Stack.
I didn't know much about Oscars in those days. I never even went over, which, if I'm looking in retrospect, I would have gone. David said to me afterwards, he said, yours was the first to come up. And he said, I knew when you won, we were going to be on a good run. But in those days, they didn't pay for us to go, and my husband and I didn't have that much money to fly about to L.A. and back and things. And I always also thought it looked a little like pot hunting, you know, like you thought you were going to win, which I didn't. For a moment thing, I was even asleep when they rang me and told me I'd won. So it was pretty unexpected, I have to tell you.
Someone who did show up that night, covering the Oscars for the Los Angeles Times, was journalist and historian Bob Osborne.
I was at that Academy Awards ceremony. I remember it very well. Lawrence of Arabia was the big winner, won 7 Academy Awards that year. And what was very much in the air that night, what kind of was permeating the industry at that time, strangely enough, had nothing to do with these movies, but had to do with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. That was right at the height of their making Cleopatra in Rome. It had also had a big effect on 20th Century Fox because so much money had been spent on making Cleopatra that Fox was in dire financial trouble. But that year, Daryl Zanuck's The Longest Day came out, and that was up for the Academy Award opposite Lawrence of Arabia. So there was a lot of tension about studios and how financially solvent they were.
Against this background of financial considerations, what were the chances of Lawrence of Arabia against the 4 other Best Picture nominees, which were not just The Longest Day, but also The Music Man, Mutiny on the Bounty, and To Kill a Mockingbird? David Thompson.
It was a predictable winner, I think. It was a true epic in the sense that The Longest Day, one of its competitors in that year, was not really a true epic, a very ill-made, ill-put-together film. Lawrence of Arabia was doing something that everybody could say to themselves, well, only the movies can do that.
Certainly, Peter O'Toole had a passing resemblance to JFK, but no, there's no doubt that there's an heroic sense to the Lawrence character that's rather akin to the Camelot ethos of Kennedy. I think that's one element.
Professor Toby Miller, director of film studies at the University of California, sees a link between the American political atmosphere in the early 60s and Lawrence of Arabia's success.
If you look today at some of the debates going on in the U.S. military about what to do with the occupation of Iraq and the insurgency, where are they going to? They're going to the Seven Pillars of Wisdom, Lawrence's so-called memoir, so-called history, maybe novelization of his life, and his account that you also see in the picture of the Arabs undermining the Turks through a kind of guerrilla insurgency, as per what we see in Iraq today. And some of the ideas that Lawrence derived from that experience are being put into the playbook now of the United States military. So on the one hand, I think there's something very specific to the early 60s, that sense of optimism, of moving beyond the Cold War binarism that had divided the Soviet Union from the United States, the East from the West, embodied in people like Kennedy. And on the other hand, I think you have something that's much more general and that is about what happens when cultures come together.
I think the film was sort of a foregone conclusion that year, but the acting awards were not.
I present the Oscar for the best performance by an actor. Those nominated are Burt Lancaster in Birdman of Alcatraz, Jack Lemmon in Days of Wine and Roses, Marcello Mastroianni in Divorce, Italian Style, Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, the winner is Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird.
O'Toole.
Losing to Gregory Peck.
Losing to Gregory Peck. Well, all respect to Gregory Peck, but I mean, the Lawrence performance is towering. I mean, it really is. It's a career-defining moment. And one of the speculations is that opinion had turned against O'Toole somewhat because he'd been a bit loud and a bit overly refreshed on the American talk show circuit, and there was felt that perhaps he was a little bit above himself and needed taking down. That's only a rumour. I have no idea whether that's true or not.
Gregory Peck is great in To Kill a Mockingbird, but he's also become by that time a venerable actor who, in a sense, should have won for something. So it's also a career recognition rather than just an award for To Kill a Mockingbird. And then you get the reverse, which is the Peter O'Toole phenomenon, the actor who endlessly is getting nominated. He was recently nominated for Venus, almost as a kind of token, wistful nostalgia for Peter O'Toole, and then again, not getting it.
Academy Awards night is always full of surprises. I don't know anyone at any Oscar party who has ever predicted a completely accurate list of winners. Not all the decisions are satisfying. Citizen Kane did not win Best Picture, Alfred Hitchcock never won Best Director, and Peter O'Toole has yet to win a competitive Oscar. But Lawrence did win. And O'Toole is Lawrence, more than the music, more than the desert, more even than David Lean himself. And I think he knows it.
Who are you to know what can be done? If we'd done what you thought could be done, we'd be back in Yenbo now and nowhere.
Although it's not so uncommon for the cinema to produce spectacles, and it's not so uncommon for the cinema to produce intimate character studies, it's very rare that they're yoked together in quite such a successful and quite such an epic manner as Lean's film.
Do you think I'm just anybody, Ali? Do you?
Lawrence, in this day, you know, just seems larger and larger. I mean, I think when I talk about film and where film has gone, I'm always bringing it up and saying, you know, where are the Lawrence of Arabias today? We're not making these films. We're losing these films.
My friends, who will walk on water with me?